Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast with me, Patrick Gray, and with Tom Uren, who'll be joining me in just a moment. Seriously Risky Biz is the podcast and newsletter we do here at risky.biz, where we focus on items, cybersecurity items that are mostly of interest to the policy set. So we're talking big picture stuff. This work is supported by the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative and also by our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint. Tom Uren, it is great to have you back after you had last week off. And let's dive into the discussion now. The first thing I want to talk about today with you is a report that you found from the Council of Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, which basically says that the dream of a sort of unfettered, you know, global free internet is pretty much dead.
Yeah. What I liked about this report is that it says things that I think are almost self-evidently true, but it's as if global or US foreign policy has been behaving as if they're not true. So some of the things it finds are the era of the global internet is over. We had this vision of a utopian future for the internet and it's just not going to happen. Cybercrime is a national security risk. Ransomware attacks on hospitals and governments should be seen as such. So we had a, you know, there's a nuanced discussion to be have there, had to be had there, but broadly I agree. The US has failed to impose sufficient costs on attackers. So in the sort of cyber operations, attackers continue to do things that we don't like, but we haven't been able to stop them. So these are just truths. Yet it seems like from a foreign policy perspective, the US government hasn't internalized and recognized these. One particular thing is that one of the co-chairs of the report is actually President Biden's nomination for the new State Department Cyber Bureau. So he is likely to take some of these views into US government policy and advocate for them. So I think it's a foreshadowing of some of the things that may happen in US foreign policy when it comes to the internet and cyberspace.
Yeah, so that sort of utopian dream is over. And look, as much as you say that the stuff in this report is self-evident, I still found that it was pretty stark sitting at there stacked together as a bunch of bullet points, right? Because it does drive home pretty effectively that this dream is over.
Yeah. I think exactly the same thing happened to me. You look at the first statement, the era of the global internet is over, and it seems like you can have a debate about whether that's true. The next bullet point in their major findings is US policies promoting an open global internet have failed, and Washington will be unable to stop or reverse the trend. And again, you could have a discussion about that and you could sort of argue about it. But when you stack them all up together, they make quite a compelling argument that the foreign policy has been focused on achieving something that just can't be achieved.
Yeah.
And so when you realize that, you've got to step back and think, well, what can we do and how should we do it? And the report argues that for a start, we've just got to have more limited goals. We've got to recognize reality and then strive hard for something that we can actually achieve. So some of the suggestions I like are creating a global internet crime organization to try and bring together law enforcement bodies around the world. So in the newsletter all the time, I talk about international collaboration on particular operations. And the report says that those operations are pulled together for particular purposes and then they disperse. And so really what we need is an ongoing effort that occurs all the time to
A cyber Interpol, I had to say it. Sorry. But I mean, that is kind of what you're describing, right? Which is some sort of global body that coordinates, that serves as a coordination mechanism between law enforcement.
Yeah, exactly.
A cyber Interpol.
Yeah. Now, one of the other parts I really like is it says that the US can no longer treat cyber and information operations as two separate domains. And both the PRC and Russia think of them as maybe not the same thing, but as a continuum. And so one particular quote I like, the report talks about the meeting of Russian and US defense officials after the creation of US Cyber Command. And a Russian general is really dismissive of Cyber Command because it lacks an information warfare role. And he tells his counterparts, one uses information to destroy nations, not networks. And if you look at the back and forth in information operations in the last couple of years, you sort of step back and you'd have to think that perhaps the Chinese and the Russians maybe are doing quite well, and perhaps we're missing a trick by keeping the two separated.
What, so you're arguing we should go full pelt into internet propaganda? I understand that why policymakers would feel icky about even thinking about doing that.
Yeah, and I think we can't do the same thing that they're doing, but I think there's a different approach to tackling it from our point of view that requires like an overarching strategy. Maybe, you know, and I think there's good reasons that that function is not in Cyber Command, but I think there's, what I see is that there's just no strategy at all around dealing with that. It's very much point solutions, often left up to social media companies. I mean, I think it's just ridiculous that what could possibly be a really dramatic threat is just left to social media companies, depending upon what possibly Elon Musk may think about what is the right solution.
I just feel like when US intelligence agencies get involved in the narrative forming business, it doesn't typically have great outcomes. That's all, you know, that's what
I'm getting at.
So I kind of understand why the approach is different.
Oh yeah, yeah. I understand why the approach is different. I think I'm more arguing that we need to start with a strategy and then figure out who should be doing what.
Yeah.
Right now there's no strategy. If you don't have a strategy, who should do what? What's the basis for making that decision?
No, I understand that. And I think, though, we have seen a tactic emerge through the Russia-Ukraine stuff, which is this pre-bunking that the United States did in the lead up to the war, which was, you know, you could argue that was a form of information operation, which was to take intelligence, declassify it, put it out there and try to achieve some sort of effect with it. And that was trying to shape the narrative, but it was doing it from a position based in fact, not fancy copywriting and deceptive, you know, approaches. So, I can definitely see where you're coming from on all of this. One thing I want to point out too is that, like, you know, for a long time we've talked about balkanization in terms of things like the Chinese internet, where it's very strictly controlled. One thing I think the Russia-Ukraine conflict has shown us is that countries that might not be in the, you know, on the friendliest terms with the United States, where most of our software comes from, countries that aren't on the friendliest terms with the US are all of a sudden looking at the extent to which they are dependent on American technology to run their computer networks and systems, and they don't like it at all. So while we've seen some fragmentation in terms of control of information and access to information and whatnot, I think we're going to see an absolute flurry of sovereign tech. Some of it good, some of it bad, but we're going to see a flurry of sovereign tech emanating out of countries like China in particular. Do you agree with that? That we're going to see like China getting serious about having its own homegrown OS, stuff like that?
Yeah, there was that news just the other week that they're investing in, is it Kyron OS or Kylan OS?
I remember the story, but I mean, we have seen similar initiatives kind of announced in the past that didn't necessarily go anywhere. I feel like the difference now is that the case to do it is very, very clear.
Yeah, I think the Russia in this case is really an example for other countries of what could go wrong. And it really makes things real when you see a concrete example. That's much more persuasive than the theoretical perhaps we'll be in that situation one day. It's not hard to come up with that scenario and see the consequences.
It's gone from the hypothetical to the real. And I think everybody sees that. So one thing that you mentioned is that to me is that the you know, there's sort of a bit of an argument about whether or not things like ransomware attacks and cybercrime are actually national security issues. I think there's even like a dissenting opinion published in this report that we're discussing that argues that it isn't. You and I had a discussion while we were editing the newsletter that you wrote this week. And I think it was an interesting enough conversation to repeat here, right? And the gist of the conversation is national security agencies are probably best placed to tackle cybercrime, transnational cybercrime, but that doesn't necessarily automatically make it a legitimate national security threat. Tell me more about, expand on that thought, please, because I did find that very interesting.
Yeah. So in my view, the most serious threats are the most serious national security threats are the ones that result in the end of your way of living, your government. And cybercrime is not one of those, at least not for Australia, not for the US. And perhaps for maybe some smaller countries, it is a more significant difficulty.
Costa Rica was one example that I cited where a ransomware crippled government services. We're seeing something similar happen in Albania right now.
Yeah. And even in those cases, my feeling is that they'll muddle through eventually. So they're, you know, it's bad. And I could sort of argue both ways.
Yes.
I think for the US and Australia and bigger, more capable countries, they're not a national security threat in the same way. However, the national security apparatus really has the tools and techniques that you can use to sort of proactively tackle cybercrime that comes from countries that aren't going to cooperate with law enforcement.
Yeah.
So they've got the tools that can reach out and touch someone somewhere else. So
The report
actually talks about the justification for that from a legal point of view. There's a responsibility for states to tackle malicious activity arising out of their own country. If they're not doing that, we have the right to resort to taking our own steps. And in that case, I think the national security apparatus, like Cyber Command, and the equivalents elsewhere could and should be used to disrupt cybercrime that's having an effect.
I wonder about like if it's more comparable to plane hijackings in the 70s. And piracy seemed to be the metaphor that I like best, right? Because it is ransomware in particular, it seems to be a lot like piracy. And then you think about those hijackings in the early 70s where people would demand ransoms, demand money, things like that. Seems to be a crime type like that, which depending on who's actually doing the hijacking, that kind of determines whether it's a national security threat or not, right? So if it's someone like DB Cooper who's doing it because they want $200,000, then it's probably not a national security risk. If it's someone from some paramilitary group based out of Germany, then it is, right? So I think there is nuance here, I guess is the point. I don't think either you or I have a solid answer to it, but it is an interesting discussion.
Yeah. I like the analogy with piracy. It, you know, if it reached such a level, it could be a national security risk. And that's why you have the Navy patrolling the seas and disrupting piracy.
They are a military agency, right, that aren't a crime-fighting agency. So I guess the metaphor still holds. Anyway, food for thought. That's just to get everyone's, you know, brain juices flowing out there. You did cover some other stuff this week too that was quite interesting. You did a bit of a deep dive on the TrickBot leaks. And something that you and I have spoken about quite a lot just through the course of our work is that the actual number of criminals pulling the strings on the majority of the pointy end of the cybercrime ecosystem, it's not actually that many people. And that's what these TrickBot leaks have kind of found as well. A firm based in the UK took some doxing data basically from the TrickBot crew and put together a report on it. We covered it in the main Risky Business podcast as well. But I mean, that was the finding that you found interesting, wasn't it? Was the overlap between the TrickBot people and Conti, and the fact that really, you know, if you took 20 of these people and threw them off a bridge, you'd probably make a bit of an impact on cybercrime more broadly.
Yeah. So what I thought was really interesting is a particular message that's in the report. And it talks about the chief disappearing.
Now, when you say message, I should clarify for listeners that what you mean is it was a chat message between some of these criminals, and there's a particular message you're talking about.
Yeah, it was a chat message sent to a broader group. It says that they're going on a 2 to 3 month shutdown because the chief has disappeared. So the author's been delaying saying anything because he doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know how to pay salaries. I was dragging my feet, he says. I presume it's a he. Screwing around with the salary as best I could. But the chief is gone and the situation is not getting any softer, and pulling the cat by the balls makes no sense anymore. So they're really lost without the chief there to guide them.
Well, I always love to learn a new idiom from a foreign language.
I thought that was fantastic.
Pulling the cat by the balls is certainly one that I haven't heard before. So, you know, one point to Russia for that one.
Yep. And that just highlighted to me a key individual disappearing really throws the whole enterprise into disarray. And in a normal business, you have people who can act up, you know, people take leave, you have someone replace you, you have a deputy who you trust, But that's not necessarily true in cybercrime gangs. So it looks like there's just no, no hierarchy. Yeah, no contingency plans, no failover plans. If someone disappears, you haven't necessarily trusted anyone else with access details or credentials to get into the money. And so
now, you wouldn't be suggesting that we make some of these people disappear, would you, Tom?
I am not one for like actual physical violence, but I think there's definitely operations that could be done that would disrupt their identities within those groups. If they're not meeting in person, how do they reestablish who they are?
If you vape someone's every one of their accounts, right, whether that's their instant messenger accounts, email accounts, destroy all of their key material, if you can destroy their ability to prove their identity, you know, that say it's the chief disappears and then someone pops up, you know, a month later claiming to be the chief from a completely different set of identifiers, you're probably not going to trust that person, are you?
No, and I think if you manage to even vape some of their communications and then pop up in many different places claiming to be chief, you know, I'm Spartacus and so is my wife.
Yeah.
I think that would be just as effective. So, and very disruptive, and it breaks down that trust, which in cybercrime gangs is hard won, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, now look, very quickly too, I want to touch on your analysis of the Cyber Safety Review Board's first ever report. They did a deep dive on the Log4j report. This is also something that I spoke about with Adam yesterday on the main Risky Biz show, but certainly we didn't do analysis to the same level of depth that you did. I guess the key takeaway from your analysis really is that the board did a good job, but the recommendations that came out of it were a little bit depressing because they were, you know, even if you adopted all of the recommendations that the Cyber Safety Review Board recommended, like it's still a massive amount of work that's going to take a number of years for them to actually bear any fruit. I mean, that's a summary of what you put together, isn't it?
Yeah, basically. The way I would describe it is the software development ecosystem is so bad that it's going to take a long time to fix.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I think their recommendations basically boiled down to we should make better software, and that's, you know, and it, again, this isn't a criticism of the board because that's the appropriate finding, but I think some people were sort of unfairly expecting them to come out with a set of like three easy things we could do to make life a lot easier, and it just, you know, life doesn't work that way. But that said, it is good to get these findings and a description of what best practice actually looks like, a description of where we should be heading, you know, get that onto the record and into the hands of policymakers. Like that's a positive thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think it gives them a list of things that they can look at and step down the report and say, you know, how are we going on this? And having that kind of document officially is useful. I think people like to compare the Safety Review Board to the National Transport Security Board that looks at aircraft investigations. And those reports get so specific. But the NCSB is also 100 years old. So we've had 100 years of building up the right structures. People know how to operate. People know why they're doing the things that they do, and there's an enforcement and literally, you know, many decades of learning and practice that goes into that.
You might imagine their first report may have said something similar to what this cyber safety report said, right? Like they might have said, we need to build better planes. And it did take a while to build better planes. But we did get there. Let's see if we do with software and technology. But Tom, you're in. Thank you very much for this chat about the newsletter. For anyone who wants to subscribe to it, you can find it at risky.biz/subscribe, and you can find a link there. Pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we'll do it again next week.
Thanks, Pat.